Hi, everyone. I know recently we announced we were going to 2 episodes a week and then 3 episodes a week. But you know what? There are just too many episodes. So we are going to back to 5 episodes a week. Still a reduction from 7, but there were just too many interviews scheduled, and I didn't want to make all the authors wait for too long. So I hope you can keep up with me. Listen to 1 a week as you're on your way to work or on your way home or putting your kids to bed or whatever it is you're doing. Moms don't have time to read books now 5 times a week.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much. Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and I am the host of this podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I am also a newly minted USA Today bestselling author of the novel Blank. I've created a whole community of book lovers around this podcast, a publishing company, reading retreats, a bookstore, and more. Learn more at zibbymedia.com or follow me on social at Zibby Owens or join the community at Zibby Readers. Steve Almond is the author of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. Steve is the author of a dozen books, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. His first novel, Which Brings Me to You, was made into a major motion picture starring Lucy Hale. His second novel, All the Secrets of the World, is under development by 20th Century Fox TV. He's the recipient of an NEA grant for 2022 and teaches at the Newman Foundation for Journalism. His work has been published in the Best American Short Stories, the Best American Mysteries, Best American Erotica, we didn't talk about that, and the New York Times Magazine. His new book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, is about craft, the struggle to write, and where stories come from. Welcome, Steve. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay. Tell listeners about this book. It's a DIY manual for the construction of stories, but it's really a lot more than that, I think. talk about the goal of the book and your background as you know, a teacher and to writer and all of that.
Yeah, I think of this as a book about the creative process. So that has three parts to it, or at least as I see it. There's the part that's about craft and learning the elements, which feels very intimidating, I think, to people who are early in their writing careers or who are not writing. It's like, oh no, it's technical, plot, character, how do I do that? So there's a section that tries to speak very simply and directly to basic elements of plot. But the creative process is also about inspiration, where stories come from. So there's a section that's about where stories come from, our obsessions, our doubts, our desires. And then there's the part that for me is kind of the heart of the book, which is, okay, you know, you want to write. That's natural. We're trying to write all the time, or at least tell stories to understand the meaning of our lives. But there are all these evil voices that rise up when we get to the keyboard that nobody talks about in your writing workshop because we keep it private. When you get writer's block, you feel ego need and anxiety about other people judging the work, or it's being rejected, or even worse, people, your beloveds, your family or friends, feeling exposed or feeling that you've broken certain silences that you shouldn't. And, you know, women in particular, moms, for instance, just as an example, because I know that's a lot of your audience, like their feelings about having children and being mothers and the expectations that are placed upon them are a burden. And oftentimes they feel ambivalent about it, but they don't feel they can speak about it. So if they decide to go to the keyboard and say, I want to write about a time I was driven so crazy by my kid, I couldn't stand it and had all these terrible thoughts. There are a lot of voices that rise up in them saying, you shouldn't say that. You must never say that. You'll be punished if you say that. And I wanted to really write about all those evil voices that you have to, you can't make them go away. I can't make them go away, but you can slowly and incrementally allow yourself to speak about the truth as long as you're going in search of the truth with mercy. That's why mercy is the bow.
Got it. Well, you do sort of sprinkle the chapters each with different writing prompts, but you don't call them writing prompts. You have some sort of name, but I can't remember.
Free writes.
Yeah, thank you.
Prompts. Thank you. Yes, prompts sounds very serious in German. It's more like free writes.
Yes, free writes.
Take the pressure off.
Yes, thank you. But I did find myself reading this book being like, ooh, I should just sit down and do some of these. Like, this would be really helpful as I procrastinate my next book, you know,
You should.
You know, I'm like, maybe I should think about like my most humiliating or like the things I don't talk about or all the different assignments. I like assignments. I feel like a lot of us, like, I don't know, people who loved school, there aren't enough assignments in this time of life. You're just like, go do whatever. So,
right. Well, what you're saying is you understanding your own process and saying, I am a person, Zibi, who needs external expectations. I don't view them as negative. I view them as the part of the way I get myself to the keyboard. And without that structure, I kind of feel adrift. I understand, you know, the big secret about my career, people say, oh, well, you know, how'd you decide to do this, that, or the other book? And oftentimes the answer is somebody asked me. And as a former journalist, I was like, yes, I'll take that assignment. Thank you for giving me some direction, because otherwise my hurricane of an ADD brain cannot focus in on the task. So that's good. So you know your process. You want some assignments. So I gave you some assignments.
Yeah, thank you.
You have them.
And thank you for that. You can tell that both your parents were therapists in the way that you took my comment and gave it back to me in a very helpful way. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, that's probably worth mentioning. My folks were both therapists, but it's also like writing isn't therapy.
No.
As a veteran of therapy, therapy is pretty boring. You know, your paid help will listen to you work through all your evasions, but, you know, the reader's not gonna. You need to distill down just the moments that really matter. You know this as a storyteller and writer, and that's part of your work, right? But I do think that that process is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. I do think that the act of trying to step back and understand your own life or write about a series of characters who in some way or another are kind of enacting your anxieties and your yearnings and your inhibitions, all of that is like part of how we come to understand and come to peace with how we're moving through life.
Yes, very true. Oh, I love all of that. So throughout the book, you address different pieces of the puzzle of writing. Writer's block is a big thing in here, which it is for many people. And I actually just wrote this whole novel about a woman who has such bad writer's block that she can't get her book in by the deadline. And so she decides to hand it in blank as a commentary on the publishing industry.
Because that's blank. Oh, yeah. I love it.
So that's what that's about. But anyway, so I'm very familiar with that, both from a character standpoint and, you know, myself. So can I just read you the things that you do to avoid writing, which is all in capitals, which is hilarious, this list?
Yes.
Okay. You said, not having as yet established a subject, I will now proceed to a digression entitled Things I Do to Avoid Writing, an area of inquiry expansive enough to accommodate its own essay or perhaps memoir. 1. Google myself. 2. Lament photos of myself that appear on Google. 3. Review my list of enemies. 4. Curse the many editors who refuse to respond to my emails. 5. Compose elaborately casual and nonetheless imploring emails, attempting to elicit a response to my previous email. 6. Urinate. 6A. Ponder if I urinate too much. 7. Recall with the peculiar fondness of middle age my last colonoscopy and mull whether it was appropriate for me to say to the doctor just before he put me under, aren't you going to buy me dinner first? Oh my gosh, you're so funny.
It was 8. Such a terrible moment.
Oh
he
my
just
gosh.
Looked at me like, just like, I am not that kind of doctor. This is a medical procedure. I am not going to participate in your weird.
Contemplate my integrity, wander upstairs for a snack, brood over why my children have no respect for me, consider an elaborately casual and nonetheless imploring email to my children, engage my wife in some complaint related to topics 1 through 11 until such a time as she asks me to repair something. I mean, that list, by the way, that's a great example of a list and one page of text that tells you so much about a person, right? Look at what you just did there. If we talk about craft and all of that, like, we know so much about you now, not only that you're funny, but all the different parts of your life and your age and your family. And I mean, it's pretty brilliant when you break it down.
Well, it's not bad to take a writer's block and say, hold on, rather than hiding from it, I'm going to build a whole book about it. Not bad.
Not bad. I mean, yeah. You know, good strategy.
Yeah, good strategy. And I think there's a deep lesson in that I was trying to get at in that writer's block essay, which is we view the moments of doubt and inhibition when we are distracted and overtaken as the enemy, as mm-hmm. something shameful. And when it gets bad enough, we call it writer's block, which is, you know, the black plague of writers. And what we do is go into isolation, quarantine, and pretend it isn't happening and not speak about it publicly. And it's such an unhealthy and self-punishing and counterproductive way to look at it. You sat there and said, I've struggled, I assume, with this feeling of being blocked and doubt overtaking my capacity to make the decisions at the keyboard. And rather than hiding from it, you said, what if I actually leaned into it and made this, you know, this anxiety and this issue central to the plot of the book. And I feel the same way about writer's block. In that essay, I realized every time I've gotten blocked, like, we need to broaden our definition of block. It isn't just when you can't get to the keyboard. I've spent whole novels blocked, where I've written these failed novels where I was, my fingers were moving, the characters were moving through rooms, but there was no heart in it. It wasn't alive on the page. I've rewritten paragraphs hundreds of times because I don't know the next beat in the story. That's a kind of block. And even when it's gotten bad enough that I couldn't get to the keyboard, it stripped me of a certain vanity that was saying, oh, you know, you should be writing the great American novel, which I'm not capable of writing, unfortunately. I can write a funny list, but I can't write the great American novel. That block was my ally. It stripped away that vanity, that idea about myself. And I was able to ask a much more useful question, which is, what do I want to write? What story will get me back to the keyboard? And I feel like the American compulsion is always to try to achieve. And, you know, you always have to do it at the highest level. And I think actually the way that people contend with when they feel blocked is just the opposite. They lower the expectations. Mm-hmm. I always say when people feel blocked, just set the expectations as low as possible. Only get to the keyboard for 5 minutes, fine. Start there. Because otherwise that negative feedback loop starts up. And, you know, the thing you're afraid of and your inability to, you know, face it becomes another reason to feel ashamed and makes it that much harder to do it.
I mean, like, we call it writer's block, but it's essentially, you know, writing anxiety. That's really all it is. It's just dealing with the anxiety of writing. And that's why it's funny when you write it down, because a lot of writers share this anxiety because it's also what makes us question things and observe things. And, you know, it's that interior monologue, which can be used for good and for bad, right? It can work with us and against us. So it's, you know, we could almost use like CBT tools of, you know, wrestling with the demons, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we think of that stuff as our neuroses and our anxieties, and therefore something that's pathological and that we should hide away. And like when we come to the keyboard, we're just strapped in and ready to go. But that's, I don't know about your experience. That's not my experience. I didn't want to write a craft book that was like, oh, the wise professor will hold forth. I mean, that's not how I feel. I feel like a mess.
Yeah.
And that list is not an exaggeration. That's literally all the gymnastics I'll go through before I try to even make a decision at the keyboard, which I'm eventually going to rewrite anyway and later cut. You know, like if people knew how inefficient our process was, they would be so deeply disappointed in us.
Yeah.
And rather than allow them to be, I'm going to say that's our process.
Yep.
You know, it's really, really hard to sit alone in a room and make decisions, and you're choked by doubt the whole time. And many of those decisions just weren't the best ones. Yep. And the more we can detach from our ego around, I am a writer, capital W, or am I a writer yet? And the more we can just say, you're just trying to make decisions and you're probably going to get them wrong a lot of the time, or you could get them righter, then the less we get into the opera of self-doubt, of like everything's at stake.
Yep.
And for me, like surrender is a big part of this. Mm-hmm. You just have to surrender that you are going to have phases in your writing career and in your writing session where you just get distracted or your doubt overtakes your sense of self-belief.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I love that. Thank you.
Well, you know what's interesting? I'm going to find blank and I'm going
to
read it.
I'll send it to you.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I'll send you a copy.
When people, I don't know about you, Zvi, when people post stuff on social media, that, and I know I get it, we're all being told to like constantly market ourselves, especially if trying to sell something as inconvenient as a book. So I get it. I do the same thing. But basically the culture says like trumpet your successes and never write about your failures. And so we all carry around our little vault of failures in silence. And we sort of look at that as a mark against us rather than saying, okay, this is a natural, inevitable part of the process. When I'm writing well, which is rarely, I'm not learning anything from it. Mm-hmm. But when I fail, I can actually look back at that and say, oh, I see, I didn't have a narrator on duty. Oh, I see, there wasn't a chain of consequence. I hadn't cleaved my crazy chain of associations to a chain of consequence, which would have created rising action. I actually am learning from all that awful prose that I was writing.
Yep.
And I think we have this feeling of trying to hide it away. And all we see in public are the published authors, the Lori Moores. You know, for me, she was like my lodestar. And I was like, oh my God, she's never written a bum sentence in her life. Mm-hmm. Nonsense. It's just that we see the little portion of decisions that, you know, move out into the world. So we believe, oh yeah, she's always just pooping gold. And it's like, nuh-uh.
Yeah. I posted a video of me reading all of my rejection letters from 2004. It's on my website somewhere. I'll send it to you also, but I saved them all. You know, they were typed back in the day. You know, I had sent in my, you know, Kinko's box of pages and gotten rejection after rejection for my first novel. And it's not easy. And I was embarrassed for so long until I realized, having talked to so many people like you and all these other amazing authors, that it is not a straight line. And so many people get rejected. And actually, that's part of it. It's actually quite rare for someone to have their first book just go. And then you think about it like art. I mean, if there was an artist, right, you wouldn't expect them to have it all be perfect.
Posting those videos of your rejection letters, one, gave people incredible hope. And it was funny for them the same way that list you read of mine is funny, because it's true and because you're brave about telling the truth. So a lot of people, I'm sure, told you, thank you for doing that. It gives me, I'm no longer alone with that myself. And that's why I feel like the social media model, which is just built to make people dissatisfied and miserable anyway, so they can be sold stuff, but it's so destructive. I want to see the version of Instagram that isn't the perfect sunset with the family all smiling. I want to see like 5 seconds later when it all goes to hell.
Yep.
I'm more interested in people's failures and struggles because that I can participate in.
Yep.
You know, their success, I like, good for you, but I want to see how you got there and know that it was difficult. and that there were a lot of rejections along the way, because then I can feel less ashamed of the real process. And I don't think there's, I mean, maybe there's some people who just out of the gate, you know, succeed and they have that talent and they're Mozart or whatever. And okay, like, I'm glad I lived at a time that I could listen to Mozart, but I'm not Mozart.
Right.
I'm schlepping along. And that's why I wanted to write the book as kind of a schlepper, not as the wise professor, but as the writer who's struggling and failing and just trying to learn from the failures.
You were so self-deprecating at the beginning. I was like, okay, is this going to be, is he going to give me any good advice? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, maybe I'm disqualifying.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to play dumb,
but
I'm also trying to make clear that doubt is with you always. And nobody gets past it. And we should stop believing that you should get past it, because it's actually really important. It's like a furnace that fuels you. And the same Zibby that's reading these rejection letters and sort of marveling at how much harder it is than she thought is going to have to show the same self-deprecation or just self-awareness or acceptance of the weak, vulnerable, unsuccessful parts of herself that allows you to then take a writing block and say, actually, this is a story. If I'm less cruel to myself and less ashamed about it, this is a story which readers will really want to participate in, because they have the same story. And it doesn't matter whether they're writers, they could be painters or filmmakers or musicians. It's the creative process.
Yes.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Actually, I've been thinking about that more and more, because our expectations of, if we were to put writers in the artist category more than we are typically thought of as, like, you know, I don't know, less in the financial modeling, you know, like output job,
content.
And more in the like, yeah, content, and more in the like, I'm doing a painting in my studio. Like, you would never expect someone with their paints and brushes to like get up to the canvas and make it perfect, right? Of course, they would repaint certain areas. We would expect that. And that's part of it. So we should give ourselves the same grace when we have a manuscript. It's the same brushstrokes. It's just we have to do it differently. It's the same keys that could do a model, you know, different tools. Same tools, different art.
Yeah. And the same in sort of for writers, I think there's this idea when sometimes people will come up to me, not often, but like, you know, after reading, somebody might come up and say, you know, I'm not a writer, but I've always had, you know, I have this great idea for a novel. I don't know if this happens to you.
Yes.
And I always have the same internal thought, which sometimes I have the good grace not to say to them. But there's like a part of me that's like, cool, why don't we meet in a year and show me your novel?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just have this thought of like, yeah, it's just about creativity and letting it flow and Kerouac and his one, you know, reeling butcher paper, you know, typewriter session. And I'm like, no, it's so disappointing and so incremental and so stop and start and so wander off to the kitchen to kvetch or eat something and then feel shame about it and think about your colonoscopy and like, ugh, that process is so human and messy. And we even as writers, we flatten that story out into, hey, after years of work, here it is, my manuscript's going into the world, like celebrate that. And I'm like, all right, I definitely want to celebrate that, but like, tell me about all the struggles along the way, because I'm in the middle of them.
Yep. Totally. Totally agree. I feel like that's when people relate to me the most, is when I'm saying like things like this morning when I thought the kids had the bus and the bus didn't show up and I forgot to check the WhatsApp. And so, you know, my husband had to get out of his pajamas and like go to school, and because I had the podcast and like, you know what I mean? And I'm like, I missed the bus again, you know, messed up the bus. You know, it's like, it's not always so pretty.
It's almost never so pretty.
Yes.
And that's why I think we carry this fantasy of, if we can represent a digital version of our lives that is so pretty, then maybe the world will believe. Like, we're always telling these two stories, the story about who we want the world to believe we are and the story of who we know ourselves to be, right? So he's like this best-selling author, and she does a podcast and her library looks great and so forth, right? That's one story to me anyway, right? I'm seeing that story. And then you're saying, no, everything's a mess and I need an assignment and I'm blocked a lot of the time and it feels like chaos. And, you know, I had to fight through a lot of rejection to even have my provisional successes, et cetera. And that is the real story. And then to me, where what's fascinating is that's where most good stories happen. Mm-hmm. The central danger is self-revelation, is the story of who we think ourselves to be colliding with who we know ourselves to be, or who the world tells us we are. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Emma, Jane Austen, mm-hmm. right? Emma is this entitled, privileged person who's sweet and smart and charming and handsome, young and rich, but she's doesn't realize that her meddling and her entitlement is really destructive. And the novel tells her that, mm-hmm. and she learns that lesson like right in front of us. And so I feel like that's the central danger, is self-revelation. And we as authors have to experience those self-revelations and accept them. Like, you're saying, I know I'm wanting to appear put together, but my life feels chaotic and I feel guilty and I've screwed this up and I've messed that up and I'm barely keeping it on the rails. And to me, like, that's the superpower that writers have. We can outlast our doubt. We can admit to it and manage it.
I love that. This is great. I'm going to lean into this on social.
I love it.
You also talk in the book, too, about finding your obsessions, things you're obsessed with. And as a kid, what you're obsessed with. And, like, just sort of going to that deepest part of you where, like, you don't know why, but, like, you can't stop thinking about, I don't know, Moose Tracks ice cream and why it was discontinued and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, all these things that you're just like, I don't know why my mind goes there. But turns out usually someone else's mind is going somewhere similar or there, too. So I loved that advice in the book as well.
Yeah, I think the way I would look at it is the reader really wants to know two things. They want to know all sorts of things. Where are we and what's at stake and so forth. But they want to know who to care about and what that person cares about. Mm-hmm. And that's what hooks them into story. And so if I say, I'm the author, Steve Allman, and I'm heartbroken that the Caravel candy bar was discontinued and I've never understood it. And the reader's like, okay, well, let's go on that journey and figure out how that happened.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think of us as finding obsessions. I think of us as really admitting to the obsessions that are already in there. We're born into obsession. You know, mm-hmm. you have kids, you know, they're obsessive in their desires. They're obsessive in their phobias. And it's kind of socialized out of them because mm-hmm. it's disruptive to feel so much and to care so much about something. But that doesn't make them go away. That just makes and go underground. Mm-hmm. And then they're spring-loaded with that force of suppression. And so for me, like, what got me out of my most sustained love when I, you know, have a novel that is basically worked on for 3 years and then it's rejected in 40 seconds, rightfully, by my agent, what got me out of that block was the obsession that it had as a kid with candy and chocolate, and realizing that that's the one thing that's going to get me out of bed, a good piece of chocolate. It's the only thing that makes me feel alive and interested in the world. And by the way, that feeling's pretty ancient. As a kid, candy was the one dependable pleasure in a childhood that was sometimes really sad and lonely. And reconnecting to that felt to me, to the guy who was trying to be a young writer and write a great novel, like, ugh, what a silly, stupid piece of pop culture nonsense I'm writing. But to readers who have their own obsessions mm-hmm. and who have hidden them away, it was like a great relief. Oh, I found somebody who feels so urgent. And the moment I got into a candy factory, the depression that I was in, not just writer's block, but depression lifted. Mm-hmm. And the elevators smelled like Halloween. And there was a conveyor belt with, you know, marshmallow bunnies shimmering, being covered in a wave, a little curtain of chocolate. And I was like, oh my God, I'm alive again. I'm paying attention to the world and I'm enthralled by it. And that's really what you're going for. I feel like as a writer, the moments of grace and creativity and sublimation are when you're more interested in the story than whether you're telling it well. You're not performing, trying to say, oh, aren't I sensitive? Aren't I smart or whatever? Mm-hmm. You're just so into it mm-hmm. that the story itself is what's pulling you forward, not your attempt to perform, but really being a storyteller. And any language you're using is serving just to tell that story. And the reader can pick up on it. Mm-hmm. They don't want, it's not the what you're writing about. It's the quality of attention that you're giving to that subject, whether it's candy bars or writer's block or oranges or some football team that you love or whatever it is.
Well, there's so much more to your story, your, you know, confessions about this sort of traumatic moment with your brother and the baseball bat later in life and your memory, his memory, you know, some very painful moments with your mom and before she passes away and talking about that and a lot of the hurt. And anyway, I really appreciated the backstory of you interspersed with all the many quotes from contemporary literature, which is also great because there are a lot of books that quote from the classics only. And you were like, no, this is, you know, people I've had on my podcast, they're quoted here. I'm like, oh, this is amazing. So I feel like it worked so well to have this contemporary look over what's being done well and great inspiring examples. And then your own story, which just shows us that the more you put your heart on your sleeve, the more you can connect with any sort of advice or whatever the main takeaway really, really is.
Yeah, I really wanted to include contemporary literature, just books. If I read, like I read Memorial Drive and it just captured me, or I read A Burning, Megha Majumdar novel, and I absolutely got obsessed with them. And I think it's important for writers and artists to be like, if you love something, then try to understand the mechanisms of its enthrallment. It's mm-hmm. not a mystery. They made a whole bunch of really good decisions mm-hmm. about narration and where to start the story and the language they chose. Study them, not like it's a holy text, but like it's holy to you. Mm-hmm. And they did it somehow. And it's not a mystery. You can try, you know, it requires a different kind of reading because you're not just taken up by the story. You're partly trying to understand as a writer. Oh, I see. You know, Natasha Trethewey starts with this photo of her mom, but actually we know from the first line of the story that her mom is going to be killed. The last photographs taken of her are at the crime scene. Oh my God. But notice how that makes us immediately know that there's a dangerous, upsetting story here. And we know that that story from the very first sentence is going to investigate that death. But then we move to this second photo that the mom constructs. And, you know, she's trying to put forward a vision of herself, finally having escaped the abusive relationship she's been in for so long. And like, those two timelines and what they tell us about how the story is going to be told. And it's just heartbreaking and remarkable. And I wanted to write a book that said, look at somebody doing it really well. I don't want to just set out ideas in the abstract. Yep. Here are people executing it. Here's how they did it. We can understand this. It's not mystical. And it's not purely technical either, but it is good decision-making. And the same thing is true of including like the story is some of the stories from my life. If I'm going to tell the reader, hey, you have to tell the unbearable story. You have to forgive yourself. You have to go in search of mercy and understanding. Then I kind of should model that.
Right.
Like I think a craft book that's just about craft is dry toast. You know, mm-hmm. you've got mm-hmm. to like put some of the hot butter of your own mess onto it. At least I felt in this book. Not so it becomes a memoir or solipsistic, but just to model for the reader, this is what I mean. You have to put some skin in the game.
Yep. Oh my gosh. I love it. Well, there's so much I didn't even get to because I could talk to you literally all day about this book and writing and everything.
I wish you would.
I really would.
It's so fun.
But I hope to meet you in person someday. And thank you so much for this book and all the advice and my new list of assignments. So thanks.
Yeah. Well, listen, will you send me blank? And then I'll send you my colonoscopy results and we'll call ourselves even.
I'm going to make myself a note so I don't forget. Okay. Yes, I'm going to send you it today.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It was a total pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you love it, please leave a review and follow us on social at Zibby Owens and at Zibby Readers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.